Welcome to Film Fragments, a podcast where we take fragments of an actor, director, and genre and tell you our favorites from their catalog. My name is Brian Suffield, I'm your host, and we're back from our break. We're finally back talking about movies again with you guys. I'm super excited to be bringing you a whole bunch of new episodes of Film Fragments. And today, what better topic to start off with than talking about Oscar-winning actor Emma Stone. She has a great catalog of films, a great career right in front of her. She's super young, but she's done so much in such a short period of time. I'm super excited to be delving into her films today, and I'm really excited to welcome today's guest. Our guest today is Lauren Puckett Pope. She is a staff culture writer over at Elle Magazine. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat today.
I'm super excited to chat with you as well. And before we get into talking about Emma Stone, I would just love to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself, talk a little bit about what you do, what got you into film, and why you love it so much.
Oh, amazing. Well, as you just said, I'm a staff culture writer at Elle, and I cover primarily film, television, and books, but I do a little bit about music and pop culture and internet culture and all of that as well. I've loved film for, you know, many, many, many years. I wouldn't say that I started out with the most robust film education, because I watched a lot of TV as a kid, and so that was sort of my lane. But I will say my dad really, really loved Marilyn Monroe. And Brian, I believe we've talked about this before. I had sort of an education in some of those classics, and that sort of opened up a door to me to, you know, watch her from filmography. And then, you know, my dad and I started watching other, you know, Oscar winners and just classic films. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Godfather, of course, you know, a lot of those typical ones. And it sort of revealed to me the wealth of culture there was surrounding these films. Obviously, you know, each one of them was sort of their own contained universe, but the fan devotion, the industry that surrounded these films, both literally in terms of making them, and then of course the media around them and all of that, that really I just became completely obsessed by. And so I worked really hard to try and catch up in terms of learning about film, and I'm still catching up to this day, but I have done a lot of really, really fun research. That's the great thing about this job, is that you get to watch and read things all day long and call it work. And yeah, I love it. I think that film and television tell us so much about what we value and why, which just makes it a fascinating way of trying to make sense of a world that feels increasingly fractured and, yeah, just like it's constantly slipping through your fingers. So I think that's part of the joy of film and television for me, is it feels like it helps me hold on to things a little bit tighter in the world around me.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. Couldn't have said it any better. And going into our topic today of Emma Stone, such a prolific actor, and mm-hmm. she's only in her mid-30s. Mm-hmm. Her career's been pretty short, but she's done so much in that period of time. So why do you think a lot of people get excited whenever they see Emma Stone's name attached to a project? Why do you think people love her so much? And what makes you such a fan of Emma Stone?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Emma Stone has had a really interesting rise and a really interesting fan base around her. And I think we have to sort of, you know, point to the elephant in the room, which is, you know, she was part of, and still is to some degree, the whole Marvel grand experiment and had a very high profile relationship with Andrew Garfield. And I think that was sort of what really exploded her into the mainstream. And she sort of, for a lot of her early career and even into, you know, Spider-Man and some of those other films, has had the girl next door, America's sweetheart, sort of the Jennifer Lawrence thing. I compare them carefully because I don't actually think they're very similar in their work and in their approach to work. But I do think they have had sort of a similar reaction amongst audiences and media of sort of like, oh my God, she's so relatable. She's so funny. She's so quirky and cute and like, OMG, just like me, you know. And I don't say that, I'm sure my voice sounded a little bit that way, but I don't say that pejoratively because I think that's part of the pleasure of actors is that they do, for better or worse, feel like a mirror to ourselves. But I do think it's very interesting because Emma Stone is a very particular kind of mirror of a very particular kind of young white woman. For many years, she has played the dork, the sort of like, yeah, quirky, lovable, girl next door who the main character, usually a man, either pines after or ends up getting, you know, put that in quotation marks, getting. And yet, she has made those roles interesting and compelling. Like, you wanted to watch more of her. You almost sort of wanted her to be the main character as opposed to being the love interest. I think about, like, with Easy A, for instance, that was such an example of her magnetism and her humor. And even in Spider-Man, you know, that was the movie, well, the series of movies that I first became, like, really familiar with her work. And I have plenty of criticisms of those films, but I do remember thinking she was so interesting. And I loved her chemistry with Andrew, of course, which was, you know, just jumping off the screen quite literally. But I was like, huh, there's something about this woman, and I don't know if it's just that I want to be like her or that she shows me something that I haven't seen, but I don't know that that's what it is. I think maybe I've seen this a million times, but there's something different here. So I think she kind of confounds a lot of people. I do think she's a talented actress. I don't know that I would say she is, you know, one of our great talents, but I do think she has made really, really interesting decisions, especially recently. And I think that we've seen a lot of her talent evolving, or maybe just her coming into it is maybe, you know, a better way of putting it, with some of her recent work, like The Favourite. I'd put Birdman up there as well, even though that's a little less recent. I'm sure we'll get into La La Land later. I just think she, for someone who has played a lot of archetypes, or a lot of a singular archetype is perhaps the better way of putting that, I think she is still oddly difficult to define for a lot of people, and that is endlessly intriguing to me.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there. I think Emma Stone is not one of my favorite actors working today. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't even say she's one of the best, but she is a talent that I'm always interested in seeing when she pumps out because, like mm-hmm. you said, she has made so many interesting decisions in her career, especially in the past decade. I mean, she's gotten 3 Oscar nominations. She's mm-hmm. even won an Oscar. She's done comedies, and she did a musical, period pieces. She's even done somewhat of a horror movie. She's done it all, and I love that Emma Stone is not an actor that sticks to just one specific genre. My favorite thing about an actor or a filmmaker is when they decide to branch out and do completely different projects one after the other. Mm-hmm. Sure, some people are just naturally better at doing just comedies or just dramas or just horror movies. But when you see someone like an Emma Stone who does something like a Birdman and a La La Land and a Favorite and a Cruella and a Zombieland and a Crazy Stupid Love and Easy A, all these different films that are so drastic from one another, it makes you more excited to see what Emma Stone is going to bring out for us to watch. And I am a fan. I'm definitely a big fan of her. I cannot wait to delve into her career with you today. So mm-hmm. I just say, without further ado, let's get into our top five films starring Emma Stone. So amazing. Lauren, what is your number five favorite Emma Stone film of all time?
Oh, gosh. Okay. This is hard because I'm trying to think of how to rank these, whether according to what I actually think is the best movie, the best performance, or just the one that has been the most compelling to me personally. So I'm going to try and do sort of like a blend of all three of those categories. I think I am probably for number five between Superbad and Crazy Stupid Love. I considered Spider-Man just because it was so integral to her career. But I don't think it's the superior film, and I don't think it's the superior performance. So I think I'm going to go with Crazy Stupid Love, which might be a controversial decision. But I think it really, really represents sort of who Emma Stone was at that time in her career and sort of the type of character that she was known for, and but you still got those glimmers of like, oh, maybe there's something else she can do here and that she's already starting to do here. So I think that'll be my number five.
Can you go a little further into why you chose Crazy Stupid Love? What makes you such a fan of that movie?
Oh, God. I don't know that I'm a fan of Crazy Stupid Love. I mean, so for one thing, it's her and Ryan Gosling, which they have had a storied on-screen many years romance. And so anytime the two of them are together, you know, I think there's a lot to unpack there. but I don't know. I mean, she's not like, I don't think this is an incredible performance of hers, but again, I think it gets to this idea of like, she's kind of the quirky girl next door, but she's got sort of a bite to her. And she plays this character who is desirable while at the same time not fitting all of the archetypes of what, or the stereotypes of what you think of as classically desirable. She is very sarcastic, and, you know, Emma Stone is so known, and it makes her recent career decisions make a lot of sense. She has these very exaggerated features. And she also makes very exaggerated movements. She has these really big eyes, and back then she was rocking the extreme side bangs and the red hair, and like, she just had this look and this way of moving her body and saying things that sort of drew your attention, even when she wasn't the focus of the scene. And I think Crazy Stupid Love is an example of that. I also think it's interesting seeing her in a romantic comedy, because I think a lot of her instincts are sort of pulled from romantic comedy. And I think we're even still seeing that in her screen work now. She's not doing as many of those films, but I think we're still seeing those sort of acting instincts, because that's where she sort of really got her first started gaining momentum. So I think that's probably why I'd put number five. But I don't know. Ask me again tomorrow and I'll probably change my answer.
So I'm going to pass on this film. It's a little higher on my list. I cannot wait to talk about it very, very shortly. I'm a huge fan of this film, so I cannot wait to delve into it just in a couple of minutes. So my number five is a comedy as well, but it's not a romantic comedy. It's a horror comedy. I'm going to go with Zombieland as my number five. I'm a huge fan of Zombieland. I'll never forget the time when this first came out. I was in sixth grade, and I remember everybody was talking about Zombieland to the point where I felt like an outsider because I saw it so much later than everyone else. I didn't see it when it came out in theaters. I watched it when it came to one of those premium channels, HBO Stars, whatever it was. And I remember for a long time, people were like, oh, you look like Columbus. And I'm like, who's that? and they're like, oh, from Zombieland. And I'm like, what's Zombieland?
Yeah.
And then I watched the movie, and then I'm like, oh, I get it. My hair was super curly back in the day, similar to Jesse Eisenberg's. So I was like, oh, okay. At least they didn't say that I acted like Columbus, because then I would have been very offended if they compared me to that character. But now, Zombieland is one of those comedies that honestly never gets old for me. When I watched it for the first time, I would watch it on loop constantly. I would come home from school, and I remember I would just play it on loop, on loop, on loop. Even that summer after it came out, I just watched it almost every single day. I was obsessed. This is one of my favorite comedies of all time. There was a period where I thought that rewatching Zombieland would make me appreciate it less, but my appreciation for it grows on every single viewing. It's not the most inventive comedy out there. It's definitely not the most unpredictable comedy out there either. But I think what makes this so fresh at the same time is that this was at a period where the zombie genre was kind of starting to rise again. This was the year before The Walking Dead premiered. And obviously The Walking Dead was a huge staple in the zombie media phenomenon in the early 2010s. But what I love so much about Zombieland, and I think what makes it work so beautifully, is the chemistry between the four leads. And specifically talking about Emma Stone as Wichita, I think she adds a lot of great comedic time into it. She definitely plays kind of like a straight man in a way. She's not exactly the most laugh-out-loud funny performer of the film, but I really love what she brings to the role. I think she rocks the black hair, honestly. I think this is one of the best looks that Emma Stone has given on screen, personally. That's just my opinion. I may have a weird taste, I don't know, but I love what she brings to this movie. I love the sister relationship between her and Abigail Breslin. I think she and Jesse Eisenberg have great chemistry as well.
Yeah.
And the brief sequences between her and Woody Harrelson I really love, too, especially when the two of them are bonded with Bill Murray and arguably one of the best cameos in film history. If anyone out there is like, oh my God, spoiler, I'm sorry. It's been about 15 years since Zombieland's come out. If you didn't know that Bill Murray was in it, then that's on you. So
Agreed.
But I love Zombieland. I'm a huge fan of this film. The sequel was okay. It was entertaining seeing these characters again, but it wasn't anything that special. But they all jumped back into their roles really, really well. It wasn't like, oh, they were just there for the paycheck. You could tell that all four of them genuinely had a great time making that sequel. And it was cool to see an Emma Stone in that sequel, because at that point in her career, she had done Birdman's La La Land, The Favourite. She had gotten all these Oscar nominations. She even won her Oscar. And I remember so well when that first trailer came out, and it was like, Oscar nominee this person, Oscar nominee this person, Oscar nominee this person. And then it ended with an Oscar winner, Emma Stone. And I'm like, there we go. That's great. I just love how they embraced that and everything. But yeah, Zombieland is my number five. I think it's a great comedy. Holds up very well. Never gets old. And Woody Harrelson as Tallahassee is one of the greatest comedic performances that I maybe have ever seen, simply because Woody Harrelson is just playing himself, essentially. So that is my number five. Are you going to pass, or is this not on your list?
It is not on my list, but not because I don't enjoy the film. It is everything that you just said, I think is probably true, but it is not on my list. So I'll go to my next one.
Alrighty. So what is your number four?
So number four for me is Easy A, which is just an Emma Stone classic. I really don't think that you can talk about her career without talking about this film. It's just sort of the I don't even know if it really counts as her breakout film. I'd have to, you know, look back into her history a little bit more. But in terms of her being a face that was recognizable, her features, again, you know, I think of that meme where, you know, her mouth just, like, drops so low and she, like, she just has this ability to morph her face. I think it's why it's going to be so interesting seeing her play, like, a Frankenstein-like character here in Poor Things, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a little bit. But, yeah, she was so funny and, as you mentioned earlier, she has great comedic timing. I don't know that it's particularly inventive comedic timing or anything particularly original, but again, I don't think that that is necessary all the time. I think as long as sometimes it's almost more effective when you are fitting into, like, the archetype of what you think of as this character. Like, again, Easy A comedy, it hits all the sort of parameters of what you expect of a sort of raunchy teen comedy, right? It's intentionally leaning into those categories or sort of descriptors of what comes to mind when you think of a teen comedy is something like Easy A. And we're sort of seeing right now this really, really fun I don't know if it's renaissance, but just sort of evolution of the raunchy teen comedy. I'm, of course, thinking of Bottoms and some of the other recent films. But Easy A was such a phenomenon, at least within, you know, certain circles. And she held that lead role with such confidence. And again, she was very quirky and relatable, while at the same time you could see this sort of edge to her. She had, I think you could look at her, that performance, and see how she would become a more dramatic actor, because I think she always had that ability to, you know, sort of squeeze these more nuanced moments in between her really exaggerated, really sort of memeable scenes and comebacks and one-liners. So I think this film sort of epitomizes the beginning of the arc of her career. Plus, it's just so much fun. It's one of those films that I feel like every time I watch it, I notice something new that makes me laugh, that is just sort of pleasurable. But I'm curious to hear, not everyone's an Easy A person, so I'm curious to hear what you think of that film.
So it's not on my list. I do really enjoy Easy A. It's been a long time since I've seen it. I'll admit that I wasn't able to get around to rewatching it for this podcast. I really wanted to set aside time to do that, but life's very hectic right now.
Yes.
There's a lot going on. So it's impossible to sit down to watch a movie that's not related necessarily to the things that you and I have going on.
It's Emma Stone Film Festival season right now.
Emma Stone Film Festival season, Fall Film Festival season. It's a very hectic time, let's just say. But I do really enjoy it. It's a solid film, and she is fantastic in it. She's absolutely hysterical. There's so many lines where just her saying it, just the way she says it, I don't know how or why, it just finds a way of being super, super funny. And I don't know. I can't really explain why it works as well as it does, but mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons why is because of her. I think she is really, really great. And I love her parents in the movie, too. Patricia Clarkson and Stanley Tucci, right? Stanley Tucci plays her dad. Mm-hmm. Oh, so good. Such great comedic timing from both of them. And I don't know why, every time I think of Easy A, the line that I think of right away is, there's a higher power that would judge you for your indecency, Tom Cruise. I don't know why that's the line I think of right away. It's just so good.
But there's so many of those that, yeah, it's a very current film for being a, you know, an older film. I'm trying to remember what year Easy A is. I want to say like 2000, I think it's 2010. You can fact check me on that, but I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it's 2010.
Yeah, okay. And, you know, so it's not as if it's super, super recent. It's pretty representative of its time. And yet it still feels, again, very current. I think of, like, Bottoms and some of the other really great teen comedies we've had recently. I mean, this isn't this year, but, like, Booksmart, you know, Easy A fits in that category and doesn't feel too dated. I wouldn't say it doesn't feel dated at all, but it doesn't feel extremely dated, which is kind of an accomplishment when it comes to really archetypal, really, you know, specific categories of comedy. So no, I agree with you. I think it's such a fun film. It really is.
It's really, really great. It would probably be my number 6 or 7. It's just right outside the top 5 for me. In terms of her performances, though, definitely top 5 performances from her, hands down. I think it was really cool when she got that Golden Globe nomination for this. It's like, oh, I didn't see that coming, but
yeah, kudos exactly.
to that. Kudos totally. To that. So my number 4 is Crazy Stupid Love, which she just talked about. Mm-hmm. And I'm a huge fan of this movie. I will admit right up front, I'm not a big rom-com guy. I don't know why. My favorite romances are the ones that are very raw and depressing and honest. Like a recent Past Lives, for example.
Yes. So good.
Romantic comedies to me, I love a good cheesy comedy. Who doesn't? I love to laugh more than anyone. But romantic comedies, it's like, okay, when I watch movies like this, I set my expectations really high, mm-hmm. and then I can't have what these characters have in these movies, so that's why I don't love them as much as everyone else. Or perhaps I'm just a very cynical human being and I don't realize that, but Crazy
Stupid
Love
I don't think that's true. There's many, many cynical people who love rom-coms, so
that is true. That's a very, very good point. But, yeah, I love this movie, and to talk specifically about Emma Stone, mm-hmm. not the most memorable performance of the film, for sure, but the thing that is definitely the most memorable aspect of the movie is in relation to her character, and I'm not going to spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it, but that twist in the movie, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, if anyone out there says that they saw that coming, you're absolutely lying. Nobody could have saw the twist that happened in this movie, and it's so clever too, because you watch the trailer for this movie and you think it's just going to be stories that intertwine and there are their own separate thing, but there's a way where it all ties together in the last act of this movie so brilliantly that it could have easily faltered the movie, but it managed to work specifically because of how it was written and how the performers were performing their particular sequences and everything. I mean, Ryan Gosling is definitely the standout of this film. He's absolutely wonderful. He's hysterical. Yes. Great comedic delivery. There's just moments where it just cuts to his face. He doesn't say anything, but it's just perfect timing. The funniest moment that I can think of right away is when he takes Steve Carell's character shopping. Steve Carell opens his wallet, and it's the loud Velcro wallet. And mm-hmm. then Gosling just pulls himself back and just looks at him in disgust. It's so perfect. And also, I have a thing with where characters always wear sunglasses even when inside. I don't understand why people do that. I don't get it. But I guess because the movie takes place in L.A., it represents yeah. L.A. people really, really well. It makes me think so much of it's funny because this character is actually your banner on Twitter. It makes me think of every time Kendall Roy is inside and he always wears sunglasses. It's like, bro,
yes,
you're inside.
Exactly.
Take off the fucking shades and just look at what's around you. We don't need you to wear shades when you're inside a house. We don't need that. But, no, I love the film. Their chemistry together is great, Ryan and Emma. I also love Steve Carell in this. I have to shout him out,
yes.
too, because I think he's great. And the kind of sneaky other MVP of this movie may actually be Julianne Moore, because Julianne Moore never really did a lot of comedies prior to this. I mean, you look at her filmography and there's not too many comedies even there, but you wouldn't expect Julianne Moore to be in a film like this. So when she screams, "Nine!" just outside the school courtyard, it's, I don't know why it works as well as it does, but yeah, great film. Love the film. I think it's fantastic, and it works so well because of all the performers in the film. And I feel like a lot of rom-coms have tried to replicate the success of Crazy Stupid Love and haven't been able to succeed in doing
that. I agree.
But there's a reason why this is regarded as one of the great modern rom-coms that we've received. Never gets old. I love it so much. And Emma Stone in it is absolutely wonderful. So now going into our number threes, what is your pick?
So number three for me is La La Land. I saw this film right when it came out. I don't remember at the time there being a whole lot of like Oscar hype around it yet, but it might have just been that it hadn't. I was younger, and I mean not like young, but I wasn't professionally working in entertainment coverage at that point, so it's possible I just hadn't heard about it. But I did not know of any Oscar buzz when I went in to see it, so I'll put it that way. So I had, you know, really no expectations going in. I just knew that it was a romantic musical drama with, you know, these two actors that I loved, whom I loved. And I was really enchanted by it. Certainly on my first viewing, I think my enchantment with it has shifted and perhaps diminished a little bit over time. But my first viewing, I was really, really taken by it. And I don't think that that was a misguided reaction, because I do think there is a real, I mean, look, there's a reason why Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone have been cast as, you know, love interests for each other multiple times. That's not something you see with just any, like, pair of actors. They have this just undeniable magnetism between them. Their comedic timing, again, they match each other so well. They manage to be both very, very dreamy and sweeping and, again, exaggerated, while at the same time making it feel real. Like, I think that's the thing about La La Land that, you know, was the subject of a lot of mocking and criticism, some of it very rightfully so, but that ultimately landed with a lot of audiences is it is a very dreamy, hyperbolic, some might even say cringy representation of romance and art and Los Angeles. I mean, again, I do think for better or worse, it is a good representation of at least a certain portrait of Los Angeles. I'm not going to say that that is the true Los Angeles or that it sort of captures the entirety of Los Angeles by any stretch.
It absolutely does not.
It absolutely does not, but I do think it captures a very specific portrait of LA that, for better or worse, usually for worse, people sort of want LA to be. You know, again, that sort of idea of like, oh, you go to LA to make it and to be a star and to make meaningful art and to fall in love and all of these things. You know, it reminds me a little bit of New York on the other side of the country, of sort of like, oh, you know, you go there to live your dream and to climb to the top of the ladder and all of those types of things. Again, it's a very specific lens through which to see the city that I don't necessarily think is accurate, but I do think it's telling. And I think it's telling that La La Land landed, no pun intended, with as many people as it did. I mean, again, that it caused all the fuss at the Oscars that it did, there's a reason for that. we can argue all day, as I'm sure we would both be able to, about whether or not it should have. But I think it's, especially within Emma Stone's career, it is a very, very, very important performance. And frankly, I do think it's a good performance. I've gone back and rewatched some of her scenes from that film, and I don't think it's her best. This is just the truth. I don't really think it should have won her the Oscar. That said, I do think it does what it is supposed to do. You know, like you're supposed to see yourself in her. You're supposed to see her, again, as we've talked about with some of these other films, she's both desirable and relatable and kind of quirky and out there. But like at the same time, she has the capability to be the dream. She has the capability to be who everyone wants. And she can be the star. She can be the A-list celebrity, which of course, you know, spoiler alert, she becomes at the end of the movie. Like, there's something about that so many of us want to hear. You know, I'm generalizing, but you know, we all feel like oddballs. We all feel like we're unlovable or whatever. And so to see the character who is the oddball, or, you know, quote unquote unlovable, then be loved by this man so intensely and to have this incredible romance and then become the A-list star and have everyone in the world just, you know, want to be her and follow her work and all of that. Like, it might be a misguided dream, but that doesn't make it any less significant, especially I think in American culture, where the American dream is so deeply embedded in all of our psyches, which I think is a big part of why this film worked. And I do think she's a lot of fun in this film. I mean, do I think that she is a particularly accomplished dancer? No. But at the same time, like, that's kind of what's fun about it, right? Is she's...
Mm-hmm.
She is a little off. Which then makes it all the more magical when she becomes an enormous star and finds her person and all of that. So I could talk about this film all day long, because I think it is, it's spectacular rise, I think, said so much about Hollywood at the time and continues to say so much about like what we think that we want out of romance and art and our careers and all of that. So anyway, that's why it's number 3 on my list, and I'll shut up now.
Okay, so La La Land is on my list, and I will get to it when I get to it, so I'm not going to say too much right now. Because it's also my number 3.
Oh, amazing!
So, I really do love La La Land a lot. You want to talk about a time where a movie came out and nobody would shut up about it? Mm-hmm. Try being a freshman in film school when this came out, and everybody wouldn't shut up about La La Land for a whole year. Yep. I remember it came out during the holiday break, and as soon as we all come back, everyone's like, "Did you see La La Land? Oh my God, La La Land, La La Land!" And I'm like, "Oh my God, calm down." But yes, I've seen it many times.
Yes.
I mean, look, what can you say about La La Land that hasn't been said already? There's so much that's already been said these last 7 years. It's hard to believe that it's been that long since this movie came out, because I remember after seeing Whiplash in 2014. I said to myself, I need to see whatever Damien Chazelle does next.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it was announced that he was doing the musical with Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone, I'm like, yep, I'm there. I'm there. I'm musical, love, two of the hottest people working today, love, yep. Sure. Director of Whiplash, absolutely. And I do not think it was the best film of 2016. It's so funny because my favorite film that year was also a musical, but it was not a conventional musical. My favorite film that year was Saint Street.
Oh, interesting.
Which is not your conventional number one of 2016. Everyone either has La La Land or Moonlight as their favorite film of that year. And I mean, look, let me just get the Best Picture debacle out of the way. Would I have been angry if La La Land won Best Picture? Honestly, no. I think it would have been one of the more talked about Best Picture winners that we've ever gotten. But at the same time, Moonlight was a very, very deserving winner of Best Picture. I think because it's a very timeless story.
Yeah.
One that still finds a way of being pretty prevalent to what's going on today.
I absolutely love Moonlight.
And I just think it's the better main movie too. I agree, I just think Moonlight is the better movie. Is it more rewatchable than La La Land? Probably not. Is it more exciting than La La Land? Absolutely not. But I think when you give a film the award of Best Picture, you want to give something that was very impactful and something that's going to be impactful for years to come. Because honestly, in terms of the last, like, maybe like 15 years of Best Picture recipients, maybe only 5 of them are still talked about to this day. I mean, obviously Everything Everywhere is the most recent Best Picture winner, but I feel like till the end of time, that's going to be one that everybody talks about because it's not the kind of film that you would have expected to win Best Picture at the Oscars. And then, obviously, Parasite, that was a deserved Best Picture winner. Moonlight, of course. No Country for Old Men, everybody still talks about. Lord of the Rings, everybody still talks about. Even Birdman, another Emma Stone film, people still talk about to this day very much. But, yeah, I think La La Land is exceptional. I think the idea of having someone who isn't necessarily the most classically trained singer in this film, I think it adds, like you said, the magic to it, and it adds to the charm of it. It's like, oh, they're just everyday people. They don't have to be Broadway-trained actors to sing their hearts out. And I think both of them do a good job in terms of the singing and everything. Is it controversial for me to say that I prefer Gosling's performance over Emma Stone's in this? Which is saying a lot, because Emma's the one who walked away with the Oscar. I don't know. I just felt...
I don't think so. I felt a little
more connected with the character of Sebastian than I did with the character of Mia. But also, Gosling is just... he's so good in this. And I mean, you guys can hear my full thoughts on Gosling in this movie in my Gosling episode that I did a while back. But I mean, La La Land, the imagery is incredible. On the filmmaking level, this is a marvel across the board. The imagery, the sets, the score, the songs aren't my favorite of all time, but I do find them all to be pretty catchy and everything.
Well, again, they're really representative. I don't think they're particularly original or exciting, but they are very representative of the dream, again, of LA, of falling in love and living for your art and your passion and all of those things. Like it's almost better that it's not the sort of classic movie musical style.
I agree.
Because I think it speaks more to the sort of flawed dream that we do have of what's supposed to happen when you go to LA or go to New York or go to wherever it is that you're supposed to quote unquote make it. So anyway, please continue.
I do think it's a great film. I understand why it resonates so much with so many people, and I understand why some people aren't as high on it as other people too. I think it's great. And I wholeheartedly agree with you. I was so worried that I was going to be the only person to say this. I do not think Emma Stone should have won the Oscar for this film.
No.
It's not a bad Oscar win. It's not a win that I'm like, oh my God, this sucks. But it's not a win where I'm like, oh, this is a great win. Because I guess the people of the Academy clearly didn't watch Jackie and saw what Natalie Portman brought to that performance. Because that, to me, was the best of those nominees that year. And it is in contention to maybe be the best performance that Natalie Portman's ever given, which is saying a lot because she won an Oscar for arguably maybe the other film that's in contention for her best performance to date.
Yeah.
But I love La La Land. It's great. It has a very special place in my heart simply because of when it came out and who I saw it with. I saw it with so many different groups of people. I saw it a lot when it came out in theaters. And I love it. I love it so much. And when Emma Stone forces I don't know why I keep saying the actor's name. When Mia forces Sebastian to play Iran at the party, and just the reaction shots on Emma Stone's face.
One of my
face
favorite
so perfect.
Scenes.
It's
yes.
perfect. It's perfect. Yes. It's so, so good. And she was actually supposed to work with Damien Chazelle again. She was supposed to be in Babylon as Nellie Leroy, but that role ended up going to Margot Robbie instead, which you could definitely sense that that role was written for Emma Stone.
Yes.
But I still think Margot Robbie did a great job in that role, so it's not a huge loss for me. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, La La Land's great. I don't know what else to really say that has been said already. I mean, the ending is incredible. It's a happy ending, but it's also a sad ending at the same time. I love it to pieces. La La Land is great, and I'm sorry to anyone listening that is going to be pissed that me and Lauren don't have La La Land in our top two. But we'll explain why when we get to our top two, which we're going to do right now. So it's time for our top two. So Lauren, tell the audience what your second favorite Emma Stone film of all time is.
All right, so my second is Birdman. I love this movie. I really do. And I'm very curious to hear what you think of this film. I was so taken with this film in a way that I don't know that I had been before it. And I guess it was the specific way in which I was taken with it. The shots, the cinematography of this film, the perspective of it, the music, that anxious drumbeat constantly in the background. I was just so entranced and agitated and anxious and uncomfortable and in love the whole time I was watching this movie. And I've seen it multiple times now. It remains one of my favorites. It's a very sort of seminal work for me in terms of really understanding why I like the films that I like. I think it did a lot to strengthen my sort of critical abilities and skills to sort of, you know, something I talk about a lot in criticism and just sort of in art appreciation in general is a lot of us can say that we really love something, a film or a show or you know, anything, but to be able to say why is something that I think surprisingly most of us, even those who are trained to do it, aren't always very good at doing. And I think this was a film where I spent a lot of time actually sitting and thinking about why I loved it as much as I did. And I think it did a lot to teach me how I need to communicate that to other people. Because I think when you have an understanding of why a work of art has an impact on you, you can, I'm not saying you always are able to, but you have the ability then to sort of transfer that to someone else and increase or shift their perception and appreciation of it as well. So anyway, I say that all to say that I might have some bias toward this film in general, which I fully acknowledge, but I do think Emma Stone is so interesting in this role because, again, she's funny. She is funny. I mean, she has that great line about how, I'm paraphrasing, but like, she talks. Yeah, she talks. And she also, oh my God, I'm paraphrasing it terribly, but I'll have to look it up and remember the exact line, but she has these one-liners. She is funny, but it's in a much more subdued way. She's a lot more sarcastic. She's a lot more depressed, which is interesting because so many of Emma Stone's characters, again, I mean, look at Mia in La La Land. Like, yes, she has her sad moments, but she's buoyed by this constant dream that she has. She's her whole life is about living dreams. I mean, that's what she says to Sebastian, is she's like, well, this isn't your dream. Like, you have to live your dream. And so to have her then play this character in Birdman where she's sort of small. Not the role itself, but sort of the way she carries herself, which is so interesting for Emma Stone because, like I said earlier, she's so exaggerated. She has such, you know, big features and big movements, and she does that, the, and we'll talk about it with The Favorite, but like slapstick movements and all of that, whereas in Birdman, she's kind of more contained. And then she has that explosive scene with Michael Keaton where, you know, she's talking about how badly he wants to be relatable and he wants this play to be important. And she's like, well, guess what? You know, you don't matter. It doesn't matter. All of us are trying to, you know, find relevancy out in the world that you don't acknowledge. But it doesn't matter and you don't matter and all of that. Like, she has this explosive scene. And if I'm not mistaken, I think that was the clip that they played at the Oscars. Again, you're going to have to fact check me there. Mm-hmm. I should have done all my fact checking before I hopped on this podcast, but I think that is correct. But anyway, I've seen this film so many times, and it continues to really mess with me in the most delightful way possible. So anyway, that's why it's my number two.
So I firmly believe we have the same two films in our top two. But crazy enough, my number two is not Birdman. My number two is the film that I guess is your number one, and you can tell me after I talk about why this is my number two. My number two is The Favorite from 2018. I have such an interesting story with this film because walking into it, I'm going to be very honest, I thought it looked terrible when I walked into it. It just looked like a film that wasn't going to be for me. And I love period pieces a lot. I'm a huge fan of period pieces. But what I don't really love always is very, very, very dry humor.
Yeah.
It sometimes it goes over my head. Sometimes I laugh at it. And I think that this is one of the most surprising movies I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. My expectations were so low, not only because I didn't think it looked like my kind of movie, but I also, at that point, was not really a big fan of Yorgos Lanthimos. I do like Killing of the Sacred Deer a lot. That movie is very, very good. But I'm sorry to offend anybody listening to this. I think The Lobster is one of the most overrated films of the last 10 years. I do think that there is a lot to like about The Lobster, but I don't entirely understand why everybody celebrates it as like this grand masterpiece of filmmaking. It's a very cool concept, but I don't think the execution was as strong as the film thought it was. Again, that's a very hot take. But The Favorite, I remember going to a 10 p.m. showing on the Thursday night because that was apparently the only time it was playing one night here in New Jersey. You gotta keep in mind, when you live in New Jersey, it's very hard to find movies like this. We don't have the luxury like Lauren does when you live in New York City. And you could go, there's like a billion showings for movies like this.
Okay, to be fair, I grew up in the middle of Missouri, so I'm very familiar with the difficulty of finding a showing. The New York luxury is relatively new to me.
Well, that's totally understandable. I'm glad that we could find some relatability there in some capacity, but I went to a 10 p.m. showing and I heard this movie wasn't exactly the most fast-paced movie. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to fall asleep during this movie. And for some reason, I was wide awake the whole time because of how much I loved it. And the humor for this was painstakingly funny. I mean, I laughed so much throughout this movie. My chest was hurting. And a lot of that has to do with these three women that are headlining the film. We'll make our way to Emma Stone last, since this is obviously an Emma Stone episode. But Rachel Weisz, incredible performance. Probably the best acting that she had presented in a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Olivia Colman.
Ugh.
True MVP of the movie. Fantastic Truly. Performance. One of the coolest Oscar wins for best actress in a very long time. Because
Agreed.
I don't think anybody saw that coming. I certainly didn't think that she was going to win for that. I thought the nomination was a win in its own, but the fact that she ended up winning for that film is saying a lot, because how often do comedic performances get recognized at the Academy? And I know this isn't a straight-up comedic performance like a Melissa McCarthy or Bridesmaids, for instance, but it's a performance that you would never expect to win an Oscar. But, my God, just so many deliveries from her specifically are amazing. She would just say these lines that may not necessarily be funny, but it's her delivery that makes it so good. Oh, we won the war. The war is over. Oh, I did not know that. Just, oh my God. So perfect. And Emma Stone, I mean, when I saw the trailer for this and I saw she was doing the British accent, I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah. Yep.
No.
Yep. No. Same.
Why don't you just cast a Brit to do a British accent? I don't get it. I just don't understand it. But then I saw the movie and I was like, it took me a while to really push aside that this is an American doing the British accent. Mm-hmm. But after about, I would say, maybe 5 or 10 minutes, I had forgotten that Emma Stone wasn't British.
Yeah.
And I love the performance. She's very maniacal in this. She's very creepy in this. She's also really funny in this. And there are moments where you genuinely do feel bad for her in some capacity because of mm-hmm. how Rachel Weisz is treating her. But then you start to not necessarily root for Emma Stone, but you're not exactly rooting for Rachel Weisz here. These are all very unlikable people, let's just say. None of the characters yes. in this movie are likable whatsoever, but it works. You still find a way of being so engrossed with the story that is unfolding and the twists and turns that are going around. This is a very unpredictable ride. It's a roller coaster that just doesn't stop. You mm-hmm. think it's going to calm down, but then the next second it just goes up. Like, it halts for maybe a split second, then it just continues on its way immediately after because something insane happens, something wild is being spoken. The best moment in the film, hands down, is when she's like, I like it when she sticks her tongue down my throat. Da, da, da. Oh, my God. The musical cues in this are great. I mean, this film is... It's insane how much I ended up loving this movie, but that's one of the best feelings about when you walk into a movie that you feel like you're not going to be as wowed by it as everyone yeah. else, but then you walk out of it being like, holy shit.
Mm-hmm.
I get the hype, and I'm on the same level. I mean, this film really blew my socks off, and it made me change pretty much my whole perspective on Yorgos Lanthimos to the point where it's like, now I'm excited to see what he does next, and we'll be yeah. definitely touching upon his next film later on this episode. But I love The Favorite. It's fantastic. It's really disheartening that the only Oscar that I believe it ended up taking was for Olivia Colman, because this should have won way more. It should have won screenplay. It should have won mm-hmm. a few below-the-line categories. I would have been okay if Emma Stone or Rachel Weisz walked away with the Oscar, because I think both of them were very, very great. And I think the sequence that sticks out to me most regarding Emma Stone that made me go, oh my God, like, she's really going all out, is when she's laying on the ground, she just bangs that book into her face multiple times. And oh, I'm just like,
yep.
Mm-hmm. I'm like, Jesus Christ. This is the girl from Easy A and Crazy yeah, Stupid Love.
Right?
Like, what a long way we've come from those movies. I love The Favorite. It's incredible. I cannot believe, I still can't believe to this day that I love it as much as I do. And I'm very happy it was a huge award success, but I wish it won more awards. I wish it took home way more awards, because mm-hmm. that wasn't my favorite film of 2018, but I think it was my favorite of the Best Picture nominees that year. That wasn't exactly the most exciting Oscar lineup, to be honest, because it was true. The same year that Bohemian Rhapsody was there, and that movie sucks. and I know that people hate on Green Book. I don't think Green Book's the worst film in the world, but it should not have won Best Picture.
Yeah.
Should not have won Best Picture. That's a different discussion for a different time. But The Favorite, it's definitely a favorite of mine for sure when it comes to Emma Stone's catalog. So that is my number two. I'm going to assume this is your number one. And if it's not your number one, I will be very, very surprised, because then I have no idea what you would pick as your number one. So tell us.
Spider-Man.
Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Yes, exactly. No, of course, the Favorite is my number one. You know, it's hard sometimes to parse how much of this performance is fully Emma and how much of it is, you know, all the elements that play into it, you know, the lighting and the framing of the camera, that fisheye lens, that really wide lens, the slapstick comedy, you know, it, but at the same time, like, that, you know, what is film if not all of those elements sort of combining to make make this chemical reaction. So I do think she is great in this movie. I really do. I think she is funny in a very, oh God, just like ugly, raw way, which somehow makes it all the more enticing, I think, particularly, well, I mean, I can only speak for myself, but particularly amongst women, there's something so strangely rich and delectable about watching a woman behave like this, and just her, like, even just her flopping into the mud, and, like, her, you know, the way she treats men, like, I don't endorse it at all, but there's something very, like, the power dynamics, and of course that's what this film is all about, but there's something very, like, oh my God, it's impossible to look away from, even if you, you know, sort of feel like you should, which I think is something that Emma Stone has been playing with a lot more, specifically within Yorgos's work, is this idea of, like, you can't look away from this. You need to watch this. Look at me. Which is really interesting. So yeah, I love this film. I love a lot of the performances in this film, which I'm sure has swayed some of my opinion. I do think Olivia Colman is just magnetic as always. I don't remember the last time I saw something of hers that didn't just completely enrapture. But I do think Emma is so interesting, and I do think her relationship with Yorgos has been so fruitful and so interesting, is part of why I'm so excited for Poor Things, and for Bleat even, because they have sort of embarked on this creative partnership almost, that you really only see with specific pairs of directors and actors. You know, I think of, like, Martin Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio, which of course is very, very, very different. But you know what I'm saying? Those relationships, they really cement themselves in both the actor and the director's repertoire or filmography. So it'll be interesting to see if this is something that they continue for years going forward, or if this is just sort of, you know, they wanted to collaborate on these few projects, or I don't know, but I do think it's a really interesting pairing. I don't know if you would have told me back in the Easy A days or the Crazy Stupid Love days that this was going to be the work that she was doing regularly, or the creative partnership that she was becoming known for. I don't think I would have believed that. But again, I think that does speak to her understanding of herself. Again, I don't think she's necessarily one of our greatest living actresses or anything like that. I do think she's talented, but I think she knows herself. She knows her features. She knows her skills. She knows her own comedic timing, and I think she's taking that and pushing it in work like The Favourite, and from what it seems, in work like Poor Things. Which is part of why this movie is at the top of my list, is because I love it. I love when an actress of any gender identity, you know, can sort of see themselves almost through, like, an outside lens, and then mold themselves and their work sort of strategically with what they see and what they notice are kind of their strengths. I think it's really, really fascinating when actors do that. And I don't always see, I mean, there's plenty of really talented actors who make a point of doing the broadest possible number of works and type and categories of work possible. And that's sort of their thing, is that they can do everything. And then there are the really talented actors who kind of see themselves and are like, oh, this is what I can do. I see it. I notice it. I can shape that. I can mold that. And obviously, you know, directors are a big part of that as well, of sort of noticing something in an actor and then sort of picking it and tweaking helping it take shape. And I think that I might be saying this a little preemptively, but I think that's what we are seeing with Emma Stone in this next stage of her career. And I think The Favourite was the beginning of that shift. I might be wrong, but that's sort of my perception, which is, again, a part of the reason why that's the film is at the top of my list, is because I'm really excited by what I hope it represents about her work moving forward.
Wow. I don't even know how to follow up with that.
Again, I could be completely wrong. So, you know, talk to me again in a few years when she's made a few more movies. But it's my hope, you know, and we've seen it before with other actors. So this could be a really, really, really cool chapter for Emma Stone. Or not. I don't know.
Well, with that all being said, my favorite Emma Stone film is Birdman.
Ugh. It was so close for me. It was so, because I love Birdman, as I have already stated on numerous occasions now.
Yeah, I mean, The Favourite was very close to being number one. It was really tough to choose between the two films, but I think Birdman is one of the best films of the whole century so far, and it says so much mm-hmm. about media mm-hmm. and, you know, finding your place and finding your purpose, and talks about Hollywood and actors and writers and theater and family, relationships, children, fathers and mothers, and special effects and all these different things. There's so much that is said in Birdman that, like I said before, I think this is one of the reasons why, one of the many reasons why people still talk about Birdman to this day as being one of the best picture winners that we've had mm-hmm. in the past 15, 20 years. I love Emma Stone's performance in this, and, you know, she's very sarcastic and dry, like you had said before, but then there are moments where you are very empathetic towards her, because you could see that she wants to get better for herself, because mm-hmm. she's a recovering drug addict, and there's just so much nuance to this performance, but there's also so many moments where she explodes and lets it all out. Mm-hmm. That scene that you brought up where she and Michael Keaton are talking, and she's talking about people who are trying to find relevance and how people strive for that pretty much every day.
Yep.
One of the best acted scenes of the last 10 years. And yes, that was Emma Stone's clip.
Okay, good. Thank you. When they were showing
all the Oscar clips and everything. And then it's so funny. You show this very serious moment, then just cuts back to her in her seat holding a Lego Oscar statue.
Yep.
So it's like, oh, way to take me out of the moment. But, I mean, you kind of had to in that moment, because that was a very serious scene. And then it's like, oh, we come back to Emma Stone being essentially Emma Stone, you know, being very goofy and silly. But, yeah, Birdman, hilarious film, very deep film as well, moving, heartbreaking, heartfelt. Michael Keaton should have won the Oscar for Best Actor. I'm sorry, that is one of the biggest Oscar upsets ever, that he did not win the Best Actor Oscar, because, mm-hmm. quite frankly, who even still talks about Eddie Redmayne's performance in The Theory of Everything? I haven't heard really anybody talk about it. And it was a good performance. He's very good in that film, but mm-hmm. that's such a safe Oscar win. Mm-hmm. It's so safe.
It's classic Oscars.
It's very classic Oscars. I like it, though, when they take risk and award performances that aren't necessarily the performances you think would win. Like, mm-hmm. Everything Everywhere winning all the Oscars that it did, it's like, I never would have anticipated that, because, again, I was in the camp for a long time to where I was saying Everything Everywhere is not going to get recognized by the Oscars. There's no way. It's just too weird and too over the top for them. But the fact that it won all these Oscars, won Best Picture,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it just comes to show that every once in a while, the Academy likes to take risks and award films that aren't your cliche Oscar-baity films. Parasite is not an Oscar-baity film, and if anyone says that it is, you're absolutely wrong, because that's a dark comedic thriller that no one probably ever anticipated even getting all the love that it got awards-wise, but then it ended up winning Best Picture at the Oscars, and Birdman is so, so cool. And I mean, the whole one-shot technique utilized here is so impressive.
It works. It's not just a gimmick. It works so
I was just
well.
Gonna, I was just going to say that. It doesn't feel gimmicky. Yeah. It really adds a lot to what Alejandro Iñárritu was trying to say and convey in this film. I also don't think Alejandro has been better than this film. I haven't seen everything he's directed. I will admit that. But The Revenant, I really like The Revenant, but I don't think it's as strong or even on the same level as Birdman. The directing in it was incredible, but story-wise, not exactly the most enticing story compared to Birdman. And Bardo, oh god, Bardo was, that was a chore. That was a bit of a chore, I'm not gonna lie. But Birdman is not a chore. It's great. The performances of the entire ensemble literally knocked my socks off. We already talked about Emma Stone. Obviously, this is her episode. She's great. Michael Keaton's fantastic. Edward Norton is amazing in this. He's so good in this. And then the supporting cast, too. Zach Galifianakis. I mean, where the hell did this performance come from? This was a great performance. Andrea Riseborough was great. Naomi Watts was great. Amy Ryan was great. I love Birdman so much. And, you know, speaking of Emma Stone endings that leave an impact on you, I still theorize what this ending of Birdman means. And I don't want to spoil it for anyone, just in case if anyone out there hasn't seen Birdman. But do you think a certain character is dead or no? What do you think?
I don't want to know. Like, that would be my response. Like, I go back and forth all the time between, like, this type of theorizing, right? I did this a ton, as all of us have, with Inception of, you know, oh, was it, what did that ending represent? And I won't spoil that either. But, you know, I remember I saw that movie for the first time and proceeded to spend, I think, like 2.5 hours at dinner with my dad just talking about the ending and what we thought the ending meant and all of that. But the thing is like, the reason why those endings end that way is because you are supposed to live in the, what's unanswered. And so I think with Birdman, like, yes, I have had moments where I've fallen more on one side or the other, but I kind of love that you don't know. Like, again, it's that, it sort of points to the whole point of the film, right? Of like, there's this tension between what might be, but you're not sure. And like, yeah, I don't know. I if you don't mind, I'm not going to answer the question, but that's only because I love the ambiguity.
Exact same way. I love that we're unsure if character is dead or alive. We don't know. And I love that it's left for the audience to interpret it and everything. Everyone has their own theories of whether or not this character actually is alive or not. We don't know. But, god, this was such a cool Best Picture winner.
It really is.
I didn't even think it would win Best Picture. I don't even know what I had. I think I had Boyhood that year as the film.
Well, I was going to say, I think it's incredible that it beat Boyhood, because Boyhood is like the classic Oscar bait of, you know, and that's not a knock against Boyhood. I think it's a good film. But, you know, I mean, film made with over multiple years has, you know, these very specific actors, and it just sort of had all of the scaffolding of what you think of as the classic Oscar film, and even, like, you know, the fact that Birdman beat out Grand Budapest Hotel, I think is pretty impressive. I mean, again, Wes is not always the most, like, Oscar-friendly director.
No, he's not.
But, yeah, and we talked a little bit about that in the past, but still, I mean, it's a great film, and it got a lot of love, so I do think Birdman winning 2014 was incredible, and I remain very, very pleased about that win to this day.
As do I. I mean, I'm a big fan of Boyhood as well, mm-hmm. and I would have liked Richard Linklater to get awarded in some capacity, because I mean, for someone to make a film like that and make it work,
yeah,
I think is an accomplishment on its own. Totally. So he really should have been awarded some. Like I personally would have been okay if Birdman walked away with picture and maybe Boyhood won directed, mm-hmm. but you can't really give Birdman best picture without giving Alejandro the directing award. It's tough. That was a great year for film.
It was honestly a lot of great films.
In terms of years in my lifetime, that might be still my favorite year of film in my lifetime. It's hard because, I mean, Birdman, Boyhood, Whiplash, Nightcrawler, Grand Budapest, Gone Girl, Guardians of the Galaxy came out that year.
I mean,
there's so many films. I liked a lot of the Best Picture nominees that year. I was pretty happy with most of them.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, Birdman is exceptional. It's really incredible. It's fantastic. And, again, I will say this till the end of the time. Michael Keaton should have won the Oscar for Best Actor, because I feel like there would be some peace if that had happened, because this is literally him.
Mm-hmm.
This role is him. He's very famous for playing a comic book character,
mm-hmm.
but Michael Keaton was out of the spotlight for many years, and it wasn't until this film where he kind of had this big comeback, and now Michael Keaton is in so many films. Everybody loves Michael Keaton. I mean, how could you not? Michael Keaton is one of the most likable presence in Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
and I love it to pieces, and I really hope that down the road there will be an Oscar-winning role written for Michael Keaton that really could lead him to winning an Oscar, because, quite frankly, he deserves an Oscar. He really mm-hmm. does deserve one, and it's disappointing that he doesn't have one, but yeah, Birdman is my favorite Emma Stone film. I love it so much. Never gets old. I've watched it countless amounts of times. Mm-hmm. I've lost count. But my God, what a picture. Truly what a picture. And that's why it's my number one. So before we get into talking about some of the Emma Stone films that didn't make the cut, let's recap our list from 5 to 1. So Lauren, what is your list?
Oh gosh, okay, what was it? I think I had 5 was Crazy Stupid Love. 4 was Easy A. 3, La La Land, 2, Birdman, and 1, The Favorite.
And to recap my list, coming in number 5 is Zombieland, number 4 is Crazy Stupid Love, number 3 is La La Land, number 2 is The Favorite, and number 1, of course, is Birdman or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance. You gotta say the full title, because why not?
Exactly.
Because why not? So that is it with our list. So let's talk about some of the films that didn't make the cut. So what are some films that you want to give a shout out to that almost made your list?
Well, you talked about Zombieland, which I'm glad that you did. I think Superbad is another one that is interesting in terms of her performance and sort mm-hmm. of what it cemented in her career and her comedic career. I liked her in Spider-Man. I really did. I think, you know, the Amazing Spider-Man series, a lot of people criticize that time in Marvel and that particular iteration of Spider-Man, and I think there are plenty of criticisms to be made. But I think that the two of them, her and Andrew Garfield, did capture something really true to the Spider-Man character of this sort of, what's the word for it? This, like, childlike adoration and energy and humor. And, you know, I mean, I think Tom Holland has captured a lot of that humor as well, in terms of, you know, I mean, his comedic timing in the Marvel Cinematic Universe has been a big part of what has made that character as lovable as he is. But I think there, you know, I mean, again, like, there's a reason why everybody loved seeing Andrew back in that costume, and Toby, too. And that's not to say that I think he's the best Spider-Man, because I don't, but yeah. I do think that all three of them capture something different about Spider-Man that makes that character so just ubiquitous. I mean, God, is there a comic book hero other than, like, maybe Superman that is quite as ubiquitous as Spider-Man and as influential? Maybe Batman. But just particularly in Marvel, pre-Avengers, I mean, Spider-Man was and is the guy. And I think, anyway, Emma Stone, like, she plays Gwen Stacy with this, like, how do I say this without sounding ridiculously corny? Like, you can see why Peter Parker falls in love with her. Like, yes, she plays the love interest, of course. Like, it's a very classic comic book storyline in that sense. But she has this humor, and she has this ingenuity, and this charm, and I really did find it really impactful in the second film when what happens happens. I won't spoil it. So I don't know. I definitely don't think it's up high on her Emma's list of performances, but I do think it deserves recognition for A, how it sort of catapulted her career into the limelight, and how she then handled her relationship with Andrew. You know, they were very, very private, and sort of the way that they dealt with tabloids was really interesting, and I think has shaped a lot of her sort of private life ever since.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I think those are probably the movies that I would mention just in terms of really important to our understanding of who she is now.
Yeah. In terms of honorable mentions for me, Superbad is fantastic. It's obviously not the first thing I think of with Emma Stone because she's not the lead in it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do love that movie very much. And I feel like it would be a disservice if I didn't shout it out because, you know, it's Superbad. It's one of the celebrated comedies. And it was her first film, too. It's,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's a very special film on that regard. I mean, obviously, Easy A, which you talked about on your list. I do like her in the Spider-Man movies. I do think she's a very good Gwen Stacy, but God, I'm not as high on those films as I want to be. And I love love Andrew Garfield. I do. I was very happy to see him back in that role, but not my favorite films, to be honest.
That is fair.
And then I guess the last honorable mention that I'll mention is Cruella. I thought she was incredible in Cruella. I thought she did a fantastic job in that. Again, another movie where I'm like, oh my God, another Emma Stone British accent? Christ almighty. But it was very punk rocky and like very different for Disney. It was a pretty dark film for Disney. I wish it went a little more into the darker themes mm-hmm. than it did. But they honestly did a pretty decent job with that because you watch that film and you're like, oh yeah, this is a Disney film. But it's so drastically different. And, you know, I was kind of worried that Emma Stone wouldn't nail the role of Cruella because even though I'm not super high on these films, even as a kid, Glenn Close's Cruella in those films was amazing. Like, so unlike anything that Glenn Close has ever done. But Emma Stone brought her own spin to the character and she really knocked it out of the park. And I also love that it reunited her with the writer of The Favourite, which I think is what made the film work as well as it ended up being. I don't know, that didn't make any sense, but I think the reason why the film worked as well as it did was because of that screenplay, and Craig Gillespie did a very good job helming it, and I love the needle drops throughout the film, and the sequences where Emma Stone is going head-to-head with Emma Thompson, that's fantastic. That was really, really delicious to watch, and if they make more movies with this character, I'm really curious to see the route that they go down with Emma Stone as Cruella. I really think she knocked it out of the park. That was a fantastic performance and a surprisingly good film in my opinion. But talking about the films that she has coming out, because there are four roles that I want to talk about that she has coming out. Obviously, Poor Things is the next thing. at the time of this recording, it just had its premiere at the Venice Film Festival and Telluride Film Festival as well, and it's going to be shown at the New York Film Festival in a couple of weeks, which me and Lauren will be attending. Very excited about that. I've been excited for Poor Things ever since it was announced. Like I said when I was talking about The Favorite, I'm excited for anything that Yorgos Lanthimos has coming out next. And Poor Things just sounded so good on paper. And then having seen the trailers, I'm like, this sounds even better than I could have imagined. And all the reviews that have come out so far at these film festivals have been very, very, very positive, which I'm not super surprised about because, you know, I didn't think that Yorgos Lanthimos was going to go down after The Favorite, but he seems to be on the same level with that, and I'm very excited to see what Emma Stone brings to this role. A lot of people are honestly saying that it's a possible career best for her, which is, again, saying a lot.
It's exciting.
That's a very exciting thing to hear, and I certainly hope that when me and Lauren see it, we're not disappointed, because the film looks so good. I mean, the imagery just looks like some of the best of the entire year, and the music, and just the concept is so unique. It's a unique take on the whole Frankenstein story that we've never seen before, and just hearing about the places that Emma Stone goes in this film, it gets me even more excited to see how this film pans out. So I'm super excited for Poor Things. And she also has another film coming out with Yorgos Lanthimos called Ant. It's an anthology film that doesn't have a release date yet. It was shot late last year, so I would assume probably sometime next year is when we have this coming out. But the cast here is pretty stacked. We have, alongside Emma Stone, Jesse Plemons, Willem Dafoe, Marco Coelho, Han Chow, Joe Alwyn, Hunter Schafer. Great lineup here. Very excited to see this. Super curious how it's going to pan out. Cannot wait for that. I really hope that Ant delivers. And another Yorgos Lanthimos Emma Stone collaboration, a short film called Bleat. Now, I don't know too much about this short, and I don't really want to know anything about it. I want to go into it as blind as possible, but they are screening it at the New York Film Festival, which is very, very exciting to hear. And speaking of New York Film Festival, another Emma Stone project that's being screened there is a series that she is starring in called The Curse, which is co-created by Nathan Fielder and Benny Safdie. And Nathan Fielder and Emma Stone star in it. I don't know too much about it, but it's essentially about a troubled couple hosting an HGTV series. I don't know what kind of show it is that they're producing, but I cannot wait to see it. It's going to be on Showtime. It's a dark comedic series. I cannot wait to watch this. I'm well aware of who Nathan Fielder is, but I haven't really delved into his career as much as I wanted to. So I'm sorry to anyone listening. I have not seen, you know, Nathan For You or The Rehearsal. I haven't seen any of those projects, but just from interviews, I really like Nathan Fielder's presence, and I'm so curious to see how he and Emma Stone work together. And this is also Emma Stone's second major show, because she did Maniac a few years back on Netflix with Jonah Hill. I have not seen that show. I heard that show was very solid, and I definitely need to check it out. But all these upcoming roles that Emma Stone has, I'm super excited to see them. I mean, three of them are literally with Yorgos Lanthimos.
Yep.
And one of them is with Nathan Fielder and Benny Safdie. So it's like, I love seeing the directions that Emma Stone is going in her career. So talk about your anticipation for each of these projects.
Yeah, I kind of what I was talking about earlier, I'm so interested in whatever sort of nugget within herself Emma Stone has discovered that she wants to, you know, mold like clay with these very, very specific creatives. I mean, Nathan Fielder, I think he's incredibly talented, but his type of comedy is incredibly specific. And I don't know that it's really super comparable to much of what she's done before, although I suppose you could make the argument that in some cases it is. But anyway, I'm really, really interested in that series as a television huge television fan and one for many years. I'm so excited to see the way that series plays out. I feel like it's either going to be incredible or it is going to not be at all. I would be surprised if it hits an in-between, but we'll see. I think it'll be probably polarizing the way that, to some extent, like the rehearsal was. But I love the premise. Oh, I love the premise. I'm so excited by just hearing you read the description. I was like, oh my God, can I watch it now? I'm really interested in Poor Things because I love women as monsters. That has always been sort of a subgenre, for lack of a better way of putting it, that has really interested me. Because seeing women in monstrosity, like true monstrosity in the sense of a Frankenstein-like creature, is just very rare. I mean, even in the context of Frankenstein, for so many years, it's been Bride of Frankenstein, right? Is what you think of when you think of sort of the woman version of that monster. And so for there to actually be like a female Frankenstein-like being, and her sort of discovering her independence and her autonomy and her sexual empowerment. I mean, I'm ecstatic by that idea. I hope that it isn't a thing where it's like, oh, she learns to erase her ugliness. I don't think that's going to be what it is, judging by everything I've heard about it and the trailer and the people behind the project. But I'm very interested in that, and I'm hoping to do a good bit of writing about it when it comes out. But yeah, you know, her other stuff I don't know as much about. I try as much as possible to not read too much about projects before I see
Absolutely.
Them. It sort of depends on what it is, like, you know, sometimes it's inevitable where it's like, okay, well, I need to research this before I go into it or whatever. But I do what I can to go in as much as possible with sort of a blank slate, unless the context is like really, really, really essential to understanding it. So yeah, but I again, reiterating what I said earlier, like, I think this could be a remarkable chapter in Emma Stone's career. And I think it could really reveal to us whether she actually is a true, you know, talent. She is a talent, but just sort of a era-defining talent. Because I wouldn't say that that's true of her right now. And that's yeah. That's not a knock against her. I just think it's factual. I think she is a good actress. I don't think she is an incredible one. But that might be shifting as she has sort of exploring this new creative manifestation of her talents. So I'm excited. I'm looking forward to seeing what's next.
Yeah, and just transition into our closing thoughts on Emma Stone. Getting to talk to you about her today and just going through her catalog and talking about these different sides of Emma Stone honestly made me appreciate her a bit more than I did probably an hour and a half ago before we mm-hmm. recorded this podcast. But yeah, Emma Stone, definitely one of the hottest talents working today. I mean, not just in terms of her acting, but looks as well. I mean, I can't deny that Emma Stone is really gorgeous and everything. Maybe one of the best redheads out there. Not my favorite redhead in the industry. That's Jessica Chastain. But, you know, that's okay. But no, Emma Stone is great. She really is great. I love seeing these different sides of her throughout all the films that she pumps out. And this chapter of everything that she's doing is definitely going to be an exciting one for her because she's branching out big time, going places that we have never seen her gone. She's done weird projects before.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like this is going to be the first time where she's doing weird projects, but to do a whole bunch of them in a row, it mm-hmm. really amps my excitement for all these projects to come and to see where she takes her career. So what are your closing thoughts on Emma Stone?
Yeah, I mean, I think everything that I have said and that you just reiterated there, like, I think this will be a defining era for her, for better or worse. My hope is that it's for better. My hope is that this really sort of catapults her into an artistic representation that goes beyond what we have seen her in. Because again, it kind of the way that Marvel sort of defined that era of her career of sort of the tentpole actress. And I would even say La La Land was sort of part of the tail end of that. She's now, I think, arguably in a different chapter. And she's in a different chapter of her own life as well. I mean, she's older, she's married, she has a child, she's been sort of, her public face has been a little bit different as well. I sense that she's moving through this really intentionally, which I think could be, remarkable. But it remains to be seen. We'll have to, circle back once the era has sort of reached its peak and see if what we, prophesized really came true.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Lauren, thank you so much for coming on today to talk to me about Emma Stone. I had such a blast talking with you today. I mean, really, you're doing wonderful things over at Elle Magazine, and it was such a blast again to spend 90 minutes today talking with you about the career of Emma Stone. So thank you so much again for coming on.
Thank you. This is such a pleasure. It is truly always a joy to get to talk through these things, because you know, when this is your job, you do a lot of time or spend a lot of time thinking about this stuff and processing it and analyzing it, but it's all sort of within your own head, and so to actually sit and talk through it all genuinely is a privilege. So I really appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. And tell the listeners where they can find you online. Where could they find your work?
Yeah, so you can find me at elle.com and in the print magazine as well. You can also find me on most social media, Instagram and TikTok and X, formerly known as Twitter, and Blue Sky, and yada yada, at Laura Puckett, L-A-U-R Puckett, P-U-C-K-E-T-T. I'll be at New York Film Festival if anyone's going to be around. Brian, hopefully I'll see you there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We'll definitely cross paths for sure. And you guys could follow me on all social medias at Brian Suffield. You guys can subscribe to this podcast on any podcast platform. We have a Twitter and Instagram, so you guys could stay up to date with what's going on in Film Fragments. Let us know your favorite film star in Emma Stone. We would really love to hear your list, see if you agree with us or disagree with us. Really curious to see where you guys rank the films of Emma Stone. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Lots of great episodes to come, so be on the lookout for that. Thanks again, everyone, from the bottom of my heart. I appreciate every single one of you. And I will see you guys for the very next episode of Film Fragments. Take care, everybody.